This is Osen Cocktail.
Hi, I'm Kirby Plessis. I have 20 years experience in intelligence analysis and OSINT, and I'm the founder of Plessis.net. You can find me online on Twitter as Kerbster.
And I'm Cynthia Navarro, and I've been a private investigator since 1979 and went into using OSINT for my investigations in 1997. You can find me on Twitter at Finnegan's Way. Today's guest is Laura Chapel. I've known Laura for many years, and I've learned so much from her. She is part of Chapel University. She also is the founder of Wireshark and has been in business for, oh my gosh, Laura, I want to say probably as long as I've known you, 20 years. So you've probably been in it for 30 years, but I'll let you give a little bit of your background, and then I got some questions for you.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, I'm not the founder of Wireshark. I was the founder of Wireshark University and the certification program. But Wireshark itself is an open source project that was created by Gerald Combs way back in the 90s. It used to be called Ethereal. So basically, I've grown up doing packet level analysis, listening in on network communications. And my last job before Chapel University and my current business was I worked at a company called Novell that's really sort of not around as much, at least not like it used to be. And I was very lucky that the CEO at that time, Ray Norda, told me to go and check out this new company, Exelan, and see what they're doing. They listen in on communications. And I went to go see this demonstration by these folks, and I just fell in love with it and said, that's it, I'm going to do that forever. And so that's really what I have been doing. And it started as a way to evangelize networking and to teach people how this all works. How do our computers talk to each other? And then, of course, naturally, it moved into more of a troubleshooting role, and then it moved into more of a cybersecurity role because people realize, oh, you're able to listen in on traffic. Look at this stuff. And then you start bringing out the tools and saying, well, let's see how this tool affects the traffic. Let me just go ahead and attack this target system. I'm going to pick up the traffic, figure out what the signatures are, and then we can take that back to our intrusion detection system. So it's kind of like this big loop that I sort of got myself into. And I still do, custom training. A lot of organizations contact me and say, we want a custom training. We need to know everything there is to know about how TCP/IP protocols work and how to use Wireshark to detect, anomalies in the traffic. And I really love it. I really love it. I'm not loving it right now because I'm updating a book, this 1,000-page book I wrote, and it's painful. But generally, I love it. Most of the time, I love it. So
you do. And all of your presentations that I've seen, I learn something every time, and I'm not even into networking. So it's wonderful. What kind of hardware are you using as far as your computers, what networks you're using, so forth?
So, it's a really interesting thing, being someone who listens in on traffic. I've got some laptops here. I've got some gaming laptops here that I like just because I like the look of them. But you don't really need a super sophisticated system to do capturing of traffic. I use taps, network taps, to listen in on traffic. They're little tiny boxes. They look like a switch or, like a really small 3-port switch, which is kind of strange, but it allows you to go and put that box in line the way the traffic is flowing. And then you hook your analyzer up to that, and you can be capturing from that switch into your analyzer, or some of the switches that I have here are awesome. They have lots of storage on them. And so they'll hold that information. And then what I do is I go to my big souped up hardware to start analyzing the traffic itself. So like capturing, we do kind of cheap lower end systems if we're going to use a computer for that, or we use these taps ideally. Then we go to the big system. And you know what? I just got in this fabulous brand new machine, and the time it takes me to analyze traffic has been cut. It's a CLX. This thing is, it's got 10 cores in it. I'm starting with 32 gigs of RAM. I'm going to probably bump it up to 64 gig of RAM. But one of the things with doing analysis is that I customize Wireshark and I tell it, I want you to have all these columns showing to me. And I want you to have all these filters so I can find that needle in the haystack. And that is processor intense, you know, when you do that. So you want a really, you know, a solid system to do that with. I've got two machines in front of me. I've got my old machine, which is a Lenovo Eraser, E-R-A-Z-E-R. That system's having a hard time keeping up. It's only got four cores in it. So I had to go to a 10 core liquid cooled system. And the other thing you absolutely have to have is you have to have the biggest monitors you can possibly stand. Multiple monitors, because I scroll my Wireshark main window across two monitors here in front of me so I can have all the columns up so I don't have to dig into every single packet to look for the details. It's up on a column. I just can look at it there and find the stuff. So, you know, I usually tell people, go get something you would get for great gameplay. You want great monitors and you want, you know, enough cores and enough memory.
You mentioned the taps. I wanted to know, where do you get these taps? And maybe it's a bigger question. Where do you purchase hardware? Because I have a feeling we don't go to the same stores.
Yeah, you know, you really need to buy the taps online. And there are some, there are a lot of vendors out in the tap industry right now. One of the tap vendors that I've had a relationship with, so I want to be, you know, disclose that, is Profit Tap. And their taps, I really like them. Number one, I love the group, Profit Tap. They're a great group of people. But I also like their taps that they have. And they have this new one called IOTA, which is just incredible. It's got so much intelligence in the tap that I'm not going to have to wade through a bunch of garbage when I get it out of that tap. I mean, it's just, they did a wonderful job in pricing, service, support, and design of their product. So I think they really did a great job. So they're probably my favorite tap vendor right now, but there are a lot of them. You can just basically go up online and you can say, I'm looking for an Ethernet tap. And you can see all these vendors show up. Some people go for the really, really low end tap and they make a mistake. Whatever, there's only one thing I'll tell you about taps to avoid. Do not buy a non-aggregating tap. In network communications, we have full duplex communications. We can transmit and receive at the same time, simultaneously on our networks. And a non-aggregating tap actually taps in the middle of that and then splits the stream going in both directions out to two different ports. So you gotta have two analyzers hanging off of that. And then you have to kind of try to combine the traffic. It never works right. Stay away from non-aggregating taps. You want a tap that will combine that flow going in both directions for you. And they can be expensive. Some of these taps can be really pricey, but they are worth the time savings and the quality. You know, some taps that are really, really cruddy out there and you'll go and you'll say, oh, I'm going to save some money. I'm going to buy a $50 tap. You'll find that they drop packets. The tap is dropping the packets. And an analyst will look at that, a new analyst will look at that and say, wait a minute. This is terrible. My network's falling apart. Look at all the packet loss. This thing is dying. It's not the network. It's the tap that's dropping these things. And the last thing you want is a new network analyst to go and plug in and be completely confounded by what they're seeing. So
when you're talking about price $50 low, what price range would you go with then?
I probably wouldn't even be looking at a tap that's less than $500. I mean, because usually you get to the really, really cheap ones. And they, you know, if you're going to put it on a network, a live network, you want to have a, you know, dual power on that tap, or you want to make sure that the tap will fail open to allow the traffic to go through if the tap fails. You want it to be aggregating. There are some amazing taps out there that you can plug lots of different network sections into. So you buy one tap and you have all these different network sections connected into that one tap. But yeah, you know, I start looking around the $500 range for the taps that would fit the type of stuff I'm doing, just even in my little home network. So, but taps can get pretty pricey. You know, they can get all the way up, you know, $10,000, $15,000.
So what else is important for you when you're going out and using other open source? What would you be out there looking for to help you?
Oh, gosh. Obviously, I'm using Wireshark to do my analysis, mm-hmm. but I might not use Wireshark to do the capture process. So TCP dump has been out there in the industry forever. It's available on all different operating systems and versions and things like that. And so I might go to a facility and there's this machine in the sales department or something, and they're saying, hey, you know, something terrible is happening in this machine. We got to see. We think it's, you know, compromised, or we think, you know, something's happening with it. I might just run TCP dump directly, or, you know, TCP dump directly on that machine, not even plug in with a tap or any, not even install Wireshark or anything, just run TCP dump on it. I just need the packets. That's it. So anybody that runs Wireshark really should understand TCP dump and have that in their kit to take around with them. I also use a hex editor because sometimes people will send me files to look at, trace files to look at, traffic files, and I don't really trust anybody ever anymore. You know, that's the thing about, unfortunately, going into this, you don't trust anyone. And having a non-technical set of parents that would send me just horrific malware as birthday cards, I mean, yeah, you just don't trust anybody. So HXD is a free tool that I use as a hex editor. Absolutely love it. It also allows me to do some altering of the contents of a file. So if I really need to show somebody a packet, and there might be some confidential information in that packet, but I've got to take a screenshot of it, I can actually go into HXD and remove that so that if I bring that up, it won't be in that packet anymore. Trace Wrangler is another cool tool that's free out there. And Trace Wrangler is an anonymizing tool made by Jasper Bongertz. He's one of the guys involved with the Wireshark project. And Trace Wrangler allows me to anonymize the IP addresses, go up and get rid of usernames and passwords. But of course, once you do that, you really need to look at it in a hex editor to make sure you've gotten rid of everything. If that file has that level of confidential information in it, do not hand it to anyone, no matter what. Not a vendor, not anybody. You know, just obviously be careful. But HXD, I love. Okay, Notepad++, of course. Another one is regular-expressions.info. That site is a great site because we use regular expressions with Wireshark. I absolutely love that. You know, I've got a list of tools that, although at the time we are speaking, it is not public, it will be by the time you guys release the podcast. It is a forensic library that I have on Zotero. So people who have Zotero accounts can just search for forensic underscore tools and they can find the library out there, or you can just pop out to chapelu.com and I'll have the link out there as well, and that's chappell then the letter u.com, and I'll pop the link up on my main page once I finish adding it. But what I've done is I've put together a list of my favorite tools, and I've classified them as to whether they are an OSINT tool or they are focused on imaging and drive related items. Are they for network forensics? Are they an IADS, IPS, or a sensor? Are they made for mobile analysis, memory analysis? So I'm just trying to put together some of my favorites that I've worked with. NetResec, anything by those folks is worth looking at. NetResec has been around for a while, and these guys did an amazing analysis of SolarWinds, the SolarWinds hack. And their site is netresec.com. They've got Network Miner out there, which has always been a great tool for reassembling stuff. So if I want to reassemble a chat session or a VoIP session or something like that, they do a fabulous job at that. They've also got this Polar Proxy, which allows you to basically proxy out on the line so that encrypted communications, you can get a decrypted version of that traffic to do the analysis. So important right now when you're doing this kind of stuff. So boy, I would tell anybody, spend a day reading everything on the NetResec site. The blogs are phenomenal. Eric just writes incredibly well and clearly, and they have really cool little tools dealing with the SolarWinds hack. to go through and decipher the domain names that are inside of the payload. Oh, it's so awesome. The blog, don't miss it. It's great.
You're compiling a lot of your favorite tools and you're putting them out on Zotero, you mentioned, and we'll have that link in the show notes. Can you explain what Zotero is and why do you choose that tool over similar tools?
Oh, so Zotero is basically a library organization system. If you haven't played with Zotero, it's really great. And I got into Zotero through the Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group that I work with. We have a Zotero library for interplanetary communications research papers. And so I got introduced to Zotero, looked at a couple other options out there. But what I like about this Zotero library product is that it's got these plugins for my browsers that work really, really well. So I can be browsing around and let's say I browse to the NetResec site and I go into Eric's blog and I really like, let's say, the blog entry on Polar Proxy and a Windows Sandbox. And I go click on that page and I want to have that in my library. Well, for me, I've got the plugin for Zotero in my browser here. So I'm sitting inside of my Firefox system and I just click one button up on the right-hand side and I will add it to my library exactly where I want it to be. It'll fill out all the information. It'll put in an abstract for it. And then let's say somebody's doing a master's paper for their school and they want to create citations. They need to build a bibliography filled with citations. Zotero is made for that. And it's not just made to allow you to build a bibliography very quickly, but also it's internationalized. So in the US, we do initial capitals on the front of every single word in a sentence, except for some prepositions, things like that. But in other countries, they don't do that. They do it in sentence case. And Zotero is made to understand global standards. So you can select what style you wish your citations to be in. I just absolutely love working. I have all sorts of libraries. You don't even want to know. I've got some weird libraries of my favorite creepy books to read and funky sci-fi movies. And maybe someday I'll share that one. I call it my slush bucket library. It's private, but maybe someday.
Yeah, when Zotero was first, out, I don't know first, but when it was out around the same time as, say, Delicious was out and Dig was out and all these different tools were out there. And Zotero, you're right, is the one that would do citations. I think there was something else that used to do citations too, but almost every one of the other ones are gone. There's some other new ones out there. For example, I like Bubble Up because it's pretty, but it won't do citations for you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that's really interesting, if you go, anybody can make their own Zotero library. So let's say today I'm going to be focusing on network scan types, and I'm just going to look at discovery scans. I would build a Zotero library for network discovery scans, go out on the internet, find all the resources, other people that might already have traffic files showing this. Maybe I want to go to the Nmap site because that's a great scanning tool. And I want to add all of this in so that at the end of my article, I have all those citations and references and all the links are in there for anybody. Another cool thing that Zotero does when it's your library and you have ownership of it, there's a timeline feature. So if I'm doing a historical document of scanning tools through the industry, I can add these items in there. And then Zotero in the timeline draws a timeline view that shows me when each one of these arrived in the industry based on the date I pulled. I go to archive.org and I pull some of the original documents and then Zotero puts in the date. And so now I've got a nice image showing exactly when those items came out in the industry. It looks really cool.
I love timelines so much.
Oh yeah. We're using that for another project that hasn't been announced yet, but I know it will be announced at some point here and I'll let you know as soon as it announces. But and the timeline is important to us because we're trying to find the first time this nomenclature was ever used in our world. And so we go and do the research and go back and archive.org and all these other locations and pop it onto our timeline. And now we've got a picture of, oh, look, it was started here, but it did not gain in popularity until 2 years later, it exploded. And that timeline shows that to us. It's really fascinating. Hey, and if people want to go and see another Zotero library besides that forensic tool library, one of the big things I'm involved in right now, which I absolutely love, is the IPN-SIG, which is the Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group, learning about how interplanetary communications works and try to educate people on that. And at ipnsig.org, there's a link to the library that we built to teach people how interplanetary communications works. And that's a pretty cool, crazy, geeky library. And if you have kids, you know, 11 years old, anything around that age, they will go crazy. We've got some amazing videos in there showing how we talk to landers and probes and orbiters.
Give a little bit more on that, because I know you've been working on it.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you a link. Listen, are we going to go way off topic here?
Sure.
But I'm going to give you this link, and especially if you have kids, nephews, nieces, whatever. And I would say, you know, fifth grade and up, maybe a 10, 11, even 9-year-olds, 8-year-olds love this stuff. But it's NASA's EYES. And the website is EYES, E-Y-E-S, dot NASA, N-A-S-A, dot gov, EYES, dot NASA, dot gov. When you go to this page, you are going to see some incredible animations for asteroids and, you know, the Mars, the descent to landing on the surface of Mars, a data visualization. This is NASA's visualization page for the world, looking at exoplanets. But if you go to the bottom of that page on the left-hand side, there is a link to the Deep Space Network. Now, on my machine, as we're talking, I'm going to click that link and I'm going to enter the Deep Space Network, because I'll bet you anything, we're talking to Webb. And we are. We're talking right now to the James Webb Space Telescope. So at the time that I click that link to the DSN now, I can see that Madrid Telescope 54 is communicating with the James Webb Space Telescope. And on the right-hand side of my screen, it tells me that, you know, how far away it is, 1.47 million kilometers, what the round-trip light time is. You can see each one of the spacecraft. I mean, you'll even see things like Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 as we're receiving signals down from Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. Right now, Mars is very active, all the Mars orbiters. We have these 5 orbiters around Mars right now. And Canberra, the antennas in Canberra are communicating with those orbiters in Mars right now. But right now, Madrid is lined up perfectly to communicate with the James Webb Space Telescope. So it is, you guys, it is so cool. And I will tell you that I'm going to be working with IPN-SIG, this group, to get an educational program out for people to understand how space communications works, because it is fascinating. And the beauty of what we're doing in space is we're bringing it back down to Earth. So this SpaceCom that we use that understands delays and disruptions because of, you know, solar flares and delays because of the distance, we're bringing all that down to Earth. And the first tests have been done between Amazon servers and Google servers to test the space communication system on Earth for situations where you have, maybe you've got a village in a very remote location and you want to communicate with it, or you want to communicate underwater. You know, you have got some issues that are not all that, you know, dissimilar to the issues that you have in space. So this is the next version of our Earth internet, using these space comms, what we call the bundle protocol and the Licklider protocol. And hopefully I will be getting an education program out there so we can bring up the next generation and train the current generation for space comms.
Well, what if I bring us right back to the OSIG cocktail topic, and what kind of computers do you need to talk to space?
Oh, you can talk to space from a Raspberry Pi. You can talk to space from Raspberry Pi, as long as you've got a decent transmitter and maybe an amplifier. But if you look at what we put on the vehicles that we land in space, or even these CubeSats going around. You know, a CubeSat is a size, it's funny when people say, oh, a CubeSat is the size of a briefcase. And then somebody says, well, what's a briefcase? It's like, oh, yeah, we used to have these rectangular things. Okay, so half of your carry-on bag. How about that? You know, if you think about that we have to have the ability to transmit through the deep space network from an object that is, you know, no bigger than carry-on luggage. I mean, it's much smaller than even carry-on luggage. You really don't have to have a super high-powered system. You just have to have enough power to get that signal amplified. And it's that antenna that you're going to that helps determine a lot as to, you know, what we can hear and what we can't hear. So our antennas on Earth, and we have these new antennas that have been coming up for the deep space network. And we've got these three locations, Madrid, Goldstone, California, and Canberra. In fact, if you Google Mars, California, go to Google Maps and put in Mars, California, and then look at the terrestrial view, and you'll be looking right down at antenna number 14, I believe, is the one it defaults to. That's our deep space network location. But yeah, Raspberry Pi, as long as you've got enough transmit power. I mean, think about the fact that we can hear Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 communicating, and they are outside of our solar system, and their transmit power is so weak, but we can still hear them.
And they were launched when technology was in a different
era. Oh my gosh, totally different era. I mean, they're not even using TCP/IP style communications like the deep space network uses. It's just incredible that we can even hear them. I mean, that was back in the 70s. That was 1977, I think, somewhere. Let's see. Yeah, Voyager 2 released August 20th, 1977. And then Voyager 1 released in September 5th. Wow.
What are we going to hear, Laura?
What are we going to hear?
Yeah.
You're going to hear a very low frequency radio signal. Okay. And I believe that they release, let's see, radio signal strength. The radio signal strength of Voyager 1 is 23 watts, and that's it. And it says that Voyager 1 signal, when it reaches us on Earth, it's less than what's called an attowatt, or a billionth of a billionth of a watt. So it's less strength, less signal strength than you would have on a digital watch. I mean, it's just incredible that we can still hear them. Now, we're not transmitting to them anymore. They're pretty much transmitting to us. They're over 11 billion miles away from us. And the radio signal is traveling at the speed of light in space. And what's weird about space is there's nothing there. That's why you can't hear anything in space, because, you know, audio goes across waves, sound waves, but there's nothing to have a sound wave on. The speed of light is about 670 miles an hour. So right now it takes around less than 20 minutes, I don't know, 18, 19 minutes for a signal to reach us from Voyager 1.
You said the speed of light was 670 million miles per hour. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's about that. Now, you got to remember, I'm not a rocket scientist. I deal with the communications, and I know about how the bundle protocol. It's really interesting how, let's say, you've got Perseverance out there, and there's data, there's images to send to us. Perseverance doesn't always send directly to Earth. Sometimes it's on the opposite side, so that, you know, it's not in line of sight. So this bundle protocol allows you to store and forward process. So it'll send something up to MAVEN, you know, one of the orbiters or something, and MAVEN will hold that until it's coming around the backside of Mars. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I can see where I can forward it to. So I'm going to forward it on to the next satellite here that's part of our communication system. And NASA and JPL were so smart so many years ago that when they put up a number of these satellites in space that were tracking things like, I don't know, the atmosphere, exoplanet atmosphere, and all this stuff, they built into it a hard drive to hold data for a store and forward communication system that was going to come later. It's like putting out the railroad tracks before you have the trains. I mean, just incredible. And so the data gets forwarded on towards Earth until it reaches us. And when we talk to them, we have the same capability where we can't talk directly to stuff on the other side of the moon. So when the Artemis project lands the habitat on the moon, when that's, if it's on the opposite side of the moon, we can't talk to it. So we relay it and we do a store and forwarding to get around that. The Artemis project is such a fascinating project for kids too, because you can give them a sheet of paper and teach them origami. And that's how the habitat is going up into space. That's how James Webb Telescope got inside of the rocket to fit inside the rocket, is they use the principles of origami. So you can take a kid and give them a piece of paper and say, let's learn a basic origami, you know, the owl image, the simple owl image, and then take them right into, guess what? That's exactly what NASA does to get objects up into space, and to fit them into a rocket. And ooh, you know, space is sexy. Space is cool. You know, it's a great way to get people interested in communications and hardware and software and code. And there's so many hooks in there to space.
Absolutely. I have to tell you that here's my connection to space. I was part of the NASA social. So I did used to go to the social event for NASA up in DC, like when the two space shuttles were nose to nose. But here's an even cooler one, in my opinion. I had a piece of artwork accepted to the Earthrise show, the 50th anniversary of Earthrise photo for Apollo 8. And I traveled there to see the show at the Kennedy Space Center. And I have pictures of my artwork sitting right below the Atlantis space shuttle.
Oh, you have got to send that to me. I would love to see that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, that is fantastic. Yeah, this week there's the NSSA conference going on back there. I just talked to somebody this morning that they're there, and it's quite impressive. That's a group that deals with security in space, space communications and all. Another interesting group.
Well, I think we are at the point where we're going to talk about our last call links. And last call is a section where we talk about something, a link that's caught our attention just recently, and we're enthusiastic to share it. And it doesn't have to be, you know, work related, but it, if it is, that's the best, you know? So Laura, what's your link for the last
call? You know, this is one that somebody gave me the other day that I found, and I just loved it. And it is, it's CyberCanon. And the full link is icdt.osu.edu. It's Ohio State University. So it's icdt.osu.edu/cybercanon. And it is their, yeah, it's their recommended reading list for really some of the most fascinating stories. Of course, it begins with Clifford Stoll's, you know, the cuckoo's egg. But it gets all the way through, you know, the Cult of the Dead Cow and Countdown to Zero Day. It's a great reading list. And it's not all, you know, how-to books. It's a lot of stories, too, that are just fascinating. I'm trying to check all of these off and get them all ordered. And then I'll never talk to anybody again because I'll be sitting reading for another 5 years.
Cynthia.
So I found one recently. For Journalist's Guide to Using AI and Satellite Imagery for Storytelling. And it is on a website called gijn.org. And it is a team of journalists and data enthusiasts working together to talk about the using of artificial intelligence to identify visual indicators within satellite imagery to chase a story. And I've actually gone to different classes for journalism, which has been quite interesting in how it can correlate with what we do in our world. So that is probably one of my favorite ones, and I'll be even checking more into that one. I just found it yesterday.
Okay, so my link is going to be actually a Twitter account. So the Start Me Twitter account. If you're familiar with start.me, that's just another place where people share a lot of their links, for example, kind of like Zotero minus the citations, right? But Start Me, their Twitter account is actually sharing a lot of their best Start Me pages, including the ones that get the best traction. And just, I just discovered that how much they were sharing even just this week. And there's a ton of great information there.
That is a fabulous account. You got me turned on to that. And you know what? There went another 20 hours. Kirby, thank you so much. I don't want to hear about that anymore. It's addictive.
Resources.
Yeah, absolutely addictive to read that stuff.
So Laura, can you tell us a little bit about how people can reach you and what you have coming up?
Yes. Well, I'm sure if you guys are into, you know, OSINT and stuff, you should be able to find me. So you can reach me at Chapel University. So that's just chapel-university or chapelu.com, spelled C-H-A-P-P-E-L-L, and then the letter U.com. You can reach me through the Interplanetary Networking Special Interest Group. If you pop out there, you'll see that I'm with the Technical Documentation Working Group. And I am also working on the IPN SIG Academy. So you can reach me there. And what we have coming up, we've got some really cool things coming up. We have a possible IPN SIG event. There's possibly an event that we will host to teach people about how this all works for interplanetary communications. And then we are going to have a WCNA boot camp coming up this year later on. And that will be a very intense 5-day class on analyzing TCP/IP communications for the purpose of troubleshooting, optimization, and network forensics. And we don't have the actual dates defined yet, but that will also be on Chapel U's site.
Thank you so much for being here with us.
Thanks. It's been fun. Anytime. I'll come back anytime. I'll get some cool space stuff up ready for you and pop back in.
Thank you. And don't forget to rate us on your favorite podcast app.
Also, please share so that we can continue sharing this podcast with you.